The Constitution of the United States, which was produced in the year of our Lord, 1787, is our nation's governing document. It is predicated on the Declaration of Independence, which says that our rights come from God. The Declaration of Independence explains why we exist as a nation. America at 250 celebrates the 250th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. Now, going back to the Constitution, producing that document was no easy task. Was it a miracle, as one man put it? The man who was there actually wrote this, quote, "It appears to me," and he wrote this after the document was produced, "it appears to me then, little short of a miracle, that the delegates from so many different states, which states you know are different from each other in their manners, circumstances, and prejudices, should unite in forming a system of national government so little liable to well-founded objections," end quote. Who wrote that? George Washington, who actually presided over the writing of the Constitution. Law professor John Eidsmo is the author of the seminal work Christianity and the Constitution, and he joins us on the program to discuss the miracle of the Constitution. I'm Jerry Newcomb, and this is Vocal Point. And John, we welcome you back. Thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you, Jerry, and this reminded me of a very good work on the Constitutional Convention by Catherine Drinker Boland, classic work titled The Miracle at Philadelphia.
Yes.
Washington was not alone in regarding this as miraculous.
Yes. How would it be a miracle? I mean, we look at it and we say, oh, this is a fait accompli. You know, it's like, hey, they met, they produced the document, and bye-bye.
Well, we talk about first and second degree miracles. One type is where God just simply defies the law of nature, like, for example, parting the Red Sea or causing the sun to stand still and so on. The other is the kind of miracle that just brings the natural forces of nature together. And this might be more the second kind. Because what the delegates did when they came together, these 55 delegates to the convention, is they brought with them the wisdom that had been accumulated through thousands of years of history, partially through God's divine revelation, partially through the law of God written on men's hearts, partially through the experiences, good and bad, of various nations. And I think God brought them together in a unique way. It was certainly a remarkable group of men. In fact, Jefferson once said of the convention, and he wasn't there, he was in France at the time, but Jefferson said it is a convention of demigods, not demagogues, but demigods, that is, part gods. He said, an abler assembly never sat in the history of North America, and I'd add probably hasn't ever sat since.
And did they believe in Christianity?
The vast majority did. In fact, Washington himself, when Washington was elected unanimously to chair the convention, and he gave some opening remarks to the delegates, and in his opening remarks he said, let us raise a standard to which the wise and honest may repair. The event is in the hand of God. So he recognized from the beginning God's hand in guiding these proceedings and bringing these people together and so on. Now, I don't think Washington would believe, as there are some who believe, that the Constitution was a divinely inspired document in the sense that Scripture is divinely inspired. After all, the delegates wrote into the Constitution Article 5, which is the means of amending it. There are no means of amending the Bible, and there shouldn't be. So they recognized that their document was not infallible, that they could have made mistakes, and that changing circumstances may require amendments in the future. But clearly, God had his hand in bringing them together. And as to whether they were Christians, the overwhelming majority were. You look, for example, at their church affiliation, and we find that out of these 55 delegates, that 28 of them, just barely over half, were members of the Anglican or Church of England, that 7 of them were Presbyterians, 6 of them were Congregationalists. These are all Congregationalists, that's your New England Puritans. The Presbyterians are your fiery Calvinists. You have 2 Lutherans, 2 Dutch Reformed, and 2 Methodists, and 2 Roman Catholics. And one whose religious preference we really aren't sure of. But that leaves about 3 who you would call unorthodox in their religious beliefs, that's about 6%. So the overwhelming majority were at least professing Christians, and for many of them, we have clear evidence of their Christian testimonies in their lives.
When you say three, is one of those three Benjamin Franklin? And the reason I ask,
yes.
Okay, one of those three is Benjamin Franklin. Okay, maybe, you know, a non-religious person, or so it may seem. And yet, isn't it true that when that convention started in early May, and then it finally finished in mid-September, there was slow going. By the end of June, Benjamin Franklin basically gave a very important speech, and I think perhaps it was the turning point of the whole convention. I want you to tell us about that, from one of the least religious of them.
Well, Franklin was not an Orthodox Christian, but that doesn't necessarily mean he wasn't religious in his own way. But Franklin possibly had been a deist earlier in life, but as he grew older, and by the time of the convention, he's 81 years old, a lot of things have happened that have caused him to change his view. And Franklin says in that motion for prayer on June 28th, where it seemed like they were in danger of breaking up without even having adopted anything, and Franklin called upon them to have daily prayer. And he said, "I have lived a long time. And the longer I live, the more convincing proofs I see of this truth, that God governs in the affairs of men." Now, you can believe God governs in the affairs of men without being an Orthodox Christian, but that is as direct a repudiation of deism as Franklin could possibly make. And he goes on to say in that speech, "And if a sparrow cannot fall to the ground without his notice, can an empire rise without his aid? We have been assured, sir, in the sacred writings." And deists would not call the Bible sacred writings. "But we have been assured, sir, in the sacred writings, that except the Lord build a house, they labor in vain that build it. I firmly believe this. And I also believe that without his concurring aid, we shall succeed in this political building no better than the builders of Babel." That coming from one of the least Orthodox men at the convention. You could probably describe Franklin as a Unitarian, but definitely not a deist, and a man who definitely saw the positive and valuable effects of Christianity in the nation. And so he was in favor of Christianity in this nation, even though he personally might not have accepted some of its doctrines.
Let me just, real quick, a Unitarian today is very different than a Unitarian in those days. A Unitarian in those days would be a non-Trinitarian, but they might even believe in Jesus, certainly the moral teachings of Jesus. 20% of Unitarians today would describe themselves as Christians. The vast majority would not. So they're two different words with one word, two different meanings depending on the year. Second point is, it's my understanding that although the forefathers or the Constitutional Convention didn't say yay or nay to the specific example of what Franklin was advocating, that they would have daily prayers there in that room, they did have some prayer together in a local church, so that fulfilled the spirit of what Franklin was asking for. Now, the convention, you know, they did have some problems, so was that part of the reason that Washington would call it a miracle, the fact that they actually did, finally fulfill the whole thing? Was it because there were, you know, like, for example, there were debates about slavery, debates about large states, small states?
Yes, those were some of the key issues. And the question, for example, of should the Congress be composed of equal representation from each state, as the small states thought it should, or should the larger states have more representatives than the small ones? And they resolved that by having a two-house legislature. Question as to whether slaves should be counted as persons for purposes of representation. And the South said, "Oh, of course we count our slaves for the number of congressmen we have." And the North said, "No, we don't." And then, "What about for taxation?" And the North said, "Yes, you count your slaves for taxation." And the South says, "No, we don't." So there were a number of issues that divided them: large versus small states, northern versus southern states, and the slavery issue particularly, and issues concerning those states that were more agricultural versus those that were more commercial and the like. And getting those interests harmonized in a document that gave the federal government enough power to govern effectively but at the same time restrained that power so it did not become tyrannical and oppressive. That was very difficult to do, and besides just the fact that you had some very remarkable men there, they were remarkable, but many times they were strong-willed in their own opinions and brilliant in defending them. But I think it was God's hand that brought them together with several things that you could call compromises, others where they debated until they reached a consensus and came together with a document that the overwhelming majority of them, all except three, in fact, were able to sign and were able to approve.
Okay, so got a question. Modern people today would say, well, if these people were so Christian, why did they allow for any slavery at all? Why didn't they just say, okay, there's going to be no slavery here in the United States of America. After all, our founding charter, the document of the Declaration of Independence says all men are created equal. Case closed.
Good question, and the answer is many of the delegates to the convention and many of America's leading founding fathers of that time were very much opposed to slavery. And then also, some of those, particularly some of those from Virginia, were of the opinion that slavery was wrong and that it should be gradually abolished. In fact, Patrick Henry even said, how can it be that I, a committed Christian, am an owner of slaves, and went on to say that under the economy at the time, there is no way I can free my slaves. They were mortgaged, as a matter of fact, and besides that, if he freed them, they'd have no way of making a living. So he said, I can only resolve to treat my slaves as kindly, as generously as possible, and to work and pray that the day will soon come that this abominable institution may be abolished from the face of the earth. Madison, who also owned slaves, said the whole Bible is against slavery. And Washington was personally opposed to slavery, and he freed his slaves upon his death according to his will. And Jefferson did not free his slaves, but nevertheless, Jefferson wrote the language in the Declaration that says that all men are created equal. And so even though Jefferson himself did not take that step, nevertheless, he sowed the seeds for equality. And those seeds are bearing fruit as time goes on, and even yet today. I think the significant thing, you look to this 1619 project, which was part of the New York Times, and the 1619 project, which tried to treat the slaves that were sold in 1619 to Jamestown as the definitive event of American history. I think really the definitive event of American history is that Americans, white and black, worked together to abolish slavery. And I'd ask the question, where do you find anywhere in the world where people who are part of a cultured society, whites, for example, in America at that time, some slave owners, some not, where they actively worked to eliminate the institution of slavery on moral grounds? You don't see that in Rome or Greece, where slavery was commonly practiced. Yes, you watch the fictional Spartacus, and you see a slave revolt. And yes, slave revolts did take place, but not because they were morally opposed to slavery. They themselves didn't want to be slaves. They'd rather be slaveholders. It's only when you get to Judeo-Christian countries like England and the United States that you see a moral crusade to abolish slavery. And that, I'd say, is the true story of America.
Yeah, I love what the late Dr. Walter Williams said. And in fact, in the series of films I made in which you were a guest as well, The Foundation of American Liberty, but Walter Williams said, slavery has been mankind's fare from the beginning of civilization, you know, up until fairly recent times. And he said, there's nothing unique about America, you know, participating in it. What is important is that the Western world has spent considerable resources to uproot it. So that's the real message there. John, we're basically out of time. Let me give your website. It is morallaw.org. And again, the name of your classic book, still recommended, highly recommended, Christianity and the Constitution. Thank you, John. All the best.
And thank you, Jerry.